outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Chain.
Well, we don't often record on Monday morning, particularly when I'm just waking up. Hi, Kyle.
Good morning, Wayne. I agree with you. I definitely had to double up on the cups of coffee this morning.
Hey, you're an hour earlier than me, man. You should already be well into your day. Things should be happening, all that good stuff.
That is true. I've been up and playing with my two-year-old daughter for the last 2 hours. So, yes, we have been up and moving. But that does not mean I've been actually consciously aware of what's been going on around me.
I see. Well, we're recording a few in advance here because I've got a big trip to Virginia coming up. And then back briefly off to Amarillo, back briefly and off to Florida. So I'm not sure how we're going to get in all the podcasts, but we've got so much to talk about. I have pages and pages of crazy notes to get back to this.
I know. We got just got to find that time, get it blocked out.
Maybe you need to do 5 podcasts a week at some point. But
all right, let's bring it on. But, I'm ready.
Wow. It needs to pay better than it does for that to happen. Well, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
And welcome to another edition of The God Journey. This time we've got a special guest all the way from Puerto Rico, Anna.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you having me here. And I am very much looking forward to this conversation and hope that I'll have something to add.
Thank you. No problem. Anna LeBaron is the name. She's the author of a book called The Polygamist's Daughter. Met you a number of years ago in Texas and crossed paths a few times with you and consider you a friend. So Kyle and I had something we wanted to talk about. And we thought, hey, it'd be great to get Anna on and get kind of her perspective because why don't you tell us a little bit of your story? If other people haven't read the book, I have. Love the book. If you haven't read The Polygamist's Daughter, get it, read it. You won't be disappointed. It's a hard story to read. It's a tragic story, but it's a triumphant story in the end. And Anna, you did a masterful job with the book. Can you give us just a little Reader's Digest of a story just to whet people's appetites?
Well, I was born and raised in a violent polygamist cult led by my father. His name is Ervil LeBaron. If you have a lot of time on your hands and you want to Google that name, it's like evil, but with an R in it.
Okay.
Ervil. And he was known or dubbed the Mormon Manson by the news media outlets that would report on the atrocities that he was responsible for in the 70s and 80s. So that was the life I grew up in. There were about 28 people who ended up dead that he ordered their hits on.
Oh my gosh.
And the first hit was carried out when I was 3 years old. So we lived life on the run from the law, both in the United States and in Mexico, depending on which side of the border we happened to be living. And life was just a series of traumatic experiences for a child. We lived life chaos, insecurity, nothing to really hold on to or dig your feet into, no ground that was steady to walk on. I ended up running away from home when I was 13 years old. So during those very formative years, there was just so much developmental trauma. There was attachment trauma. I say it's a childhood trauma characterized by abuse, neglect, and abandonment. And that was the entirety of my existence.
Wow. And you spent long stretches separated from your mother and father.
I met my father when I was 9.
Oh my gosh.
For the first time ever. And so I had a lot of siblings around. My father had 51 children and 13 wives. So we spent a lot of time with the other wives and the other children, playing, fighting. You can imagine all that happens in these, big, overgrown, oversized families, all shoved together in a little 2-3-bedroom house meant for one family of 4,
Wow.
The experience was everything that you wouldn't want a child to have to go through. All of it. Every abuse you're imagining was happening. Some of us escaped a few of them, but not all. I've spent the majority of my life as an adult pursuing healing, pursuing wholeheartedness, as Brené Brown calls it, figuring out my attachment issues with God, my father issues with God. It was too much.
I give it.
And I'm still in the healing process.
I get it. Where do you consider yourself in the healing process? I mean, do you feel, I mean, I know you're not, we're always going to be in this process till we die, but do you feel like you're making good headway? Do you feel like your life's much more stable now? I mean, just from knowing you, I would assume those things to be true.
Yes, I have. It took me getting stable before I could really deep dive into the healing process. When you're still being shaken and, you know, everything is moving ground underneath your feet, it's hard to find that safe place to begin the healing process. And so once I found my feet underneath me and had some solid ground to walk on, I was able to begin the healing journey. I started it in 1995. I was about 27 years old, 26 years into the healing process. And I finally, this year, as a matter of fact, in the spring, I was going through this process. I'm doing some spiritual formation training through the Dallas Willard Ministries. Uh-huh. And at one of the residencies, God spoke so clearly to me, so kindly and so gently, and just said the image of the man by the pool of Bethesda who had been lame for 38 years and couldn't get to the healing waters. That was the image that God was speaking through to me. And basically said, you're healed. Get up and start walking. As gently and kindly as the Spirit possibly could. Hmm. Start walking. And the image that I got was a man whose muscles had atrophied from laying there, lame. In picking up his mat and walking, the muscles were going to rehabilitate and get stronger. In that walking, because for the past, 25 years, I put my stake in the ground and said, I will not let go until you bless me. When I found out that healing was possible, that I needed it, I've wrestled this healing that I've received. I've wrestled it away from God in so many words, and I think it was a little bit necessary for me, for my personality, for who I am and how I'm hardwired. For me to have to just, hang on to it like a dog with a bone and say, I'm not letting go until you bless me. And then lo and behold, he did. And he's like, okay, you can stop wrestling now. Let's go. And I feel like I'm in the recovery, how you have surgery and then you have to go to recovery and then you go to rehabilitation. I feel like I'm in the recovery and rehabilitation room now. Like, okay, we're going to work these things out and we're going to get stronger as we go. But we're walking now.
So when you're talking about this healing process and this recovery process, is this a 6-month process? Was this a 12 month process? Fill me in a little bit on what that journey's been like and the people that God's brought alongside of you in that healing journey.
Well, there were a lot of parachurch organizations that came alongside of me. I connected to God in the church, but the healing process has happened through the parachurch organizations. Mostly outside of the church walls.
Okay.
Things like, in the beginning, it was like the walk to Emmaus. It was, divorce care when that was a reality in my life. What's that other one? The 12-step one, but for Christians.
Celebrate recovery.
Okay. Every time an opportunity came for me to engage with God in this process of healing, I said yes. I do believe in miracles. Mm-hmm. I do believe that there are people who can be healed instantly, and it's a miracle. But I also believe that just the fact that our bodies heal, like you can get a cut, and even if you don't do anything with it, as long as it's not too jagged, like it's going to heal on its own. Mm-hmm. If you apply some medication to it, it'll heal faster and better. And if you put stitches in it, it'll even be better. The results, the fact that we heal, period, is a miracle. And so I really consider myself just a walking, breathing miracle of God. Mm-hmm. That I've been able to come to the place where I am today. Mm-hmm. In the book, when I talk about finding myself in an office with a lay ministry counselor for the first time. This was 1995. Like I mentioned, that's when it started. I didn't even know at that juncture that I needed healing. I didn't know that I was messed up. I didn't understand that I had experienced trauma and what that was and the ways that forms you and the way that, you know, that makes your brain do certain things. And I had told a friend of mine about a nightmare that I had that was triggered by a family event that I had attended. And she said to me, if I make you an appointment with my lay ministry counselor at my church, will you go? And I'm thinking, what are you talking about? And I'm not sure, like, this is so weird. But I said, yes. And then she said, do you need me to drive you or do you need me to watch your boys while you're there? She knew and she saw and she insisted that I go have this conversation. So naturally, I showed up to this event. She wasn't going to have it any other way. And so I sit across from this lady. And for the first time in my life, I tell an outsider my whole story front to back in an hour. Imagine that. And this poor lady probably needed therapy after talking to me. Like, I don't know her name. I don't even know what church it was. It was in Amarillo. And I'm sitting there after an hour with me. She says, you know, the kind of help that you need is not something I can offer you here. So she was wise enough to know that this was outside of her scope of what she was doing there at that church as a volunteer. And she refers me to a professional counselor. And I show up at this counseling and, you know, I am completely unaware of the depth of the pain that I'm in and the suffering that I'm experiencing. Even though I'm the one experiencing it, I have no idea because I had just compartmentalized and shut it all down and suppressed it as best as I could until this lady came along. And in the book, I talk about it and I spell out that it took me 5 years of showing up regularly with this professional counselor before I finally tapped into that well of grief that had been inside of me. And I'm 27. And the things that had happened to me over my lifetime, I had just kept them inside. And, you know, over 5 years, she finally got to the core. And that little dike, you know, the little thing was taken out, removed from the dike, and the whole thing came out. And I sobbed and sobbed for weeks on end, months, it felt like, in her office. And I thought, okay, I'm better. Whew. That was hard work, but man, I'm so glad we're past it. And I didn't realize that was the beginning of it. I mean, if I had realized that was just the beginning, I might have lost heart.
Yeah.
And I feel like that was like hidden from me because each time I've gotten to a new level and a new layer peeled off, I've thought, finally, we've arrived. And then come to find out that just this depth of pain doesn't just go away, yeah, you know, quickly.
And yet, isn't that the gracious way that God takes us through the healing process, right? Where we have this experience of respite, of reprieve, of grace, of outpouring of love. And we don't realize that there's so many more that are going to have to come in order for us to experience that wholeheartedness. But it's like the grace in that moment was what our heart needed for that one instance.
So I hope that if you have listeners who are identifying with any part of my story, that they're not being discouraged about the healing process if they're just getting started. But what I can tell you is that at each little time, I kind of went around that circle and have to circle back around and circled back around. It felt like the Israelites wandering through the desert. Like, we've seen these miles, these, you know, signposts before. We've seen this little thing before. I've seen this before. And the image that God gave me very recently was that of there's a certain kind of shell that grows in a circular pattern. And each time the little crustacean that lives in there outgrows it. And I can't remember the kind of shell. It's evading my mind for the minute. But each time it grows, it does grow in a circular pattern. And the chamber before it closes because it doesn't fit there anymore. And that idea and that image that, yes, I've been going around in circles, but growing in the process. and making my home, my shell, these chambers that are now closed off that are too small for me. That has been the most comforting to my heart, to see myself in that way rather than just, you know, going in circles and chasing my tail, as my mom used to say.
What I love about your story, Anna, is not only the tenacity that you have towards healing. I think I had to almost hold on to it like a dog on a bone. And not because God was reluctant to give it to you, but sometimes getting to the place of healing that God wants, it doesn't just happen while we lay around on the couch and hope something changes. You know, there's a participation we always have in the things God does. And when you grow up in the kind of trauma that you did, there's not even a sense that it's trauma because it's been normalized for you. That's just all you know, right? And so you have tons of pain in it all. And you know something's wrong, something's horribly wrong, but you don't know what it is or how to gauge it. And I love that God has taken you on to a place of healing. I love that you've been tenacious in holding to the course and letting that fullness come. And I hope people are encouraged who've grown up in tremendously traumatic situations or have had experiences happen. Because for all of us, what you described about this circular healing, I think that's true for all of us, no matter what background we come from. As God's putting our life together, it's like we revisit. And each time we revisit a place, there's a deepening of it where sometimes people get this, oh my gosh, I must not be doing very well because I'm back where I was so many years ago.
I used to think we're back at square one, and it's not that way.
God's just drawing us into something deeper. Well, I asked Anna actually to be on this podcast with me, man, probably over a year ago. And we just have kind of waited till it kind of happened. And the reason was because there was a story in the Washington Times about a Harvard professor saying that people should be taken out of authoritarian households, particularly in conservative Christian families, and rescued from these bad parents. And I thought of you because I know everybody reacts to this article like the Harvard professor saying every Christian parent is a bad parent. And that's how Christians want to play it. The liberals are against this. They want, and there are probably some people who would like to do that. Maybe this woman would. I thought for you, though, this might have been a blessing. Do you look back on your life and wishing somebody had rescued you from this environment when you were like 3 or 4 years of age?
I have conflicting emotions about it. And conflicting ideas about it, because I've thought about it ever since you and I discussed this. I've just molded over and molded over in my mind. In our family, there was 51 siblings. There was so much trauma. The FBI was involved. People were doing horrendous things. One of my father's wives ended up killing for him, and she was arrested and put in prison. And the state of California put my mother in charge of her children. So CPS did get involved. The fact that they didn't see fit to remove all the children, and the fact that CPS said, we're going to let these children go to one of the other wives, I have conflicting feelings about that. My mother moved us to Denver, and CPS would be sent out regularly to go and check on these children. Like, the state of California was in charge of these children. They would send out CPS agents to go and study the household and check on the children and check on their well-being. You know, we were trained to lie. We were trained to say and do and perform and do all the right things. I don't understand how red flags weren't just waving everywhere.
So do you wish you had been rescued? Is that what you're saying?
Some of the kids did get rescued, if you want to call it that. I don't necessarily think it's that. Some of the kids did get put in foster homes in certain circumstances, and the results weren't any better. They were put in foster care, and some of the kids ran away. Some of the kids were removed from that, given back to the family. Because with foster care, the end result is always to try to get the kids reunited with the parents. That's the end result always, is they want the kids with the parents, if at all possible. And so in some cases, the kids ran away from the foster homes and back to the cult. Like, they coordinated. They were put in 4 different foster homes or something. They coordinated with each other because the foster parents were trying to let the kids see each other. And during those visits, they coordinated how they were going to all run away. And they did. And so it's not always the best case scenario for the children, even if they're experiencing difficult circumstances or the kind that we had. Being removed from your family of origin is a trauma in and of itself.
Certainly.
And so you have, I've been diagnosed with complex trauma, which is a whole nother beast, you know. Even if we had been removed, which I removed myself by running away from home when I was 13. And so that was traumatic by itself and caused all kinds of mental health struggles in addition to the ones I already had. And yet it was a better situation for me, for where I was, my siblings that ended up staying with my mom and getting carted back to Denver, their experience got worse than the things that I had experienced that drove me away to run away. All of us as adults now talk about all these experiences that we had that were so incredibly impactful and traumatic that we're all doing our best to heal from. And there's no easy answer in any of these cases, which is better, which is going to be safest. Now, if a child is being physically abused, absolutely, I think they should be removed from a home. But emotional abuse, verbal abuse, all of that happens. And while it's traumatic, being removed from what you, from the only thing you know, also is a traumatic experience. With foster care, where those children usually end up, it's not always a better situation. Unless you have a loving, caring home for those children to go to, like that's proven. There are so many problems and issues with foster care that everybody knows about. Children end up in the system, getting moved around. And if you've been traumatized and then you get put into foster care, and then there you have that compounded trauma by being removed from your home, the children don't fare very well because of the trauma. And some of the foster parents are not equipped to take care of a child and provide the needs that that child has. And so then that family is also now traumatized, that child being in that home. So it just complicates everything. So there's not an easy answer, as this Harvard professor says, and all of it is complicated. What I would really like to see is, as children are coming out of these homes, coming outgrowing the foster system, let's get them the mental health care that they need. Let's identify them, find a way, connect with them, and begin that healing journey with them.
Yeah, I think one of the things you underscore is, if parents are not the best answer for their kids, is the government the best answer for their kids? And I've stayed with some delightful people who have fostered 20, 30 uh-huh. kids, who've really changed kids' lives by yes. loving them. So, and then there's also foster homes where the kids are further abused by a father who's having only kids in the home for his amusement, sexually. And so I get that government makes a lousy answer for this. And families, when they're as broken as yours is, as was growing up. Now, you're a mom, yeah. too. So you see this also from a mom standpoint of where CPS has been too aggressive in some places to remove parents from home just because they don't like what the kids are being taught. And I know there's a reluctance. I talk to a lot of government people who are reluctant ever to break into anything that has religious overtones to it, which right. you keep describing your family yes. as a cult. So there's a religious faith uh-huh. thing and freedom of religion. And so there's a paranoia of government to do too much there because they'll run afoul of the First Amendment and be sued. And so, my goodness, kids growing up in a broken world is a very scary reality.
Where I think intervention is absolutely warranted and needed is when criminal activity is taking place in the home. Prosecute those parents and absolutely rescue those children. If you think about, like, I don't know if you remember in the state of Texas in 2008, you know, the state of Texas swooped in on that compound that Warren Jeffs had. It was a fundamentalist Mormon religious compound in El Dorado, Texas. 400 children were taken into custody by the state of Texas. spread out over all these different orphanages and care homes and foster homes across the state while they investigated the very criminal activity that Warren Jeffs is now serving a life sentence in prison for. Uh-huh. Atrocities against little as young as 9-year-old girls that he's now serving a life sentence for. They had to interview these every one of these children and do DNA testing on every one of them to figure out who had fathered which children so they could prosecute when underage girls were being used that way. And all of them were taught to lie. So all of these children are being interviewed lying about who their parents really are. And some of them didn't even know who their parents really were because of the way things were in that specific organization that's more modern. But eventually, most of the children were given back to the parents, back into this fundamentalist cult. You know, the whole time I'm watching this play out on the news and in the media, it was like seeing my whole family of origin life flash before my eyes. And my prayer and my hope for those children when that was an ongoing situation was that in getting a little taste of what the outside world held for them, that they would experience love and kindness and gentleness that they had never probably experienced before, that would give them a taste of the outside world so that they would, as they grew and they could, they would get out on their own terms, you know, in their own way, find their way out and know that the outside world wasn't this wicked, evil, vile place that they had been taught and groomed the same way I had been. You know, the world is evil and everyone is against us and it's us against the world. That was the mentality. And sure enough, about 10 years after that event, 2018, I was reading an article where they interviewed like 5 or 6 of the kids that had gotten out since then. And that was exactly what they said was, we were put in these homes and the people that were taking care of us temporarily treated us with so much kindness that we saw that the outside world wasn't this wicked place that we'd been taught it was. And that's what's needed, is when you see and you experience or you understand these are children that are being abused. These are children that are in a difficult situation, a family situation. If you're on the periphery of that, as a teacher, a neighbor, whatever, no matter what the circumstance, whether it's fundamentalist Mormonism or any kind of fundamentalist anything that's not doing right by these children, what they need is kindness. Hmm. What they need is somebody to notice them, to look them in the eye and be that person, be that light. You don't have to go and kidnap them. I mean, that's not what they need. They need kindness. They need to know that people on the outside are going to be there for them.
Which is often why cultic groups try to keep their own world. They try to keep people from having connection outside the group. And the teaching Correct. Is, and whether it's that abusive. And I guess I had to ask that question too, because you tell me when there's criminal activity involved, pull them out, is just authoritarian emotional bondage abuse in your mind?
It is abuse. It is abuse. However, it's what the kid knows and it's familiar to them. And when I was in the cult and was experiencing the things that we were going through, if you would have asked me, are you, you know, do you hate this? I would have said no. I had my siblings. We played. You know, we played endless games of Monopoly and, you know, card games forever that went on forever because we weren't allowed to play outside. You know, we made up games. We had, quote, fun mm-hmm. in the middle of what we were experiencing. We had good memories, even while we were being used as slave labor in the warehouses, sweatshops, basically working 12-hour days, you know, all summer long, paid nothing, you know, and yelled at, screamed at. Some of the boys would get whipped if they were, you know, too rebellious, quote unquote. You know, I learned real fast to not sass or talk back or whatever, because I didn't want any of that happening to me. So I learned to be submissive. I learned to do my work. But at the same time, you know, I have so many memories of my siblings and I, and there was a lot of us, you know, running around, just wild children, because that's what we were, you know.
Yeah.
During the times when there weren't adults around, and there were a lot of times when there were not adults around, and you know, we had fun in the middle of it all.
I'm just kind of curious, is there a solution in your mind? I mean, you talk about having conflicted emotions and, you know, not always pulling them out offers a better alternative. And I didn't really want to talk about this just only from this extreme case like yours. There's a whole larger distrust going on right now between evangelicals uh-huh. and government agencies, uh-huh. school districts. They've got uh-huh. the DOJ's kind of involved now in investigating threats of violence at school board meetings by angry parents. And most of these are Christian conservative parents who don't trust the schools about vaccines or masks or critical race theory. Or, I mean, there's just a whole lot of discontent and angst between those on the left and those on the right for control of our schools, for control of who decides what's going to happen with our young children in a public school environment. And so I think one of the things I want to say is don't gauge policy at a local level from extreme situations like this. This is a very extreme
Correct.
Situation. The Harvard
Right.
professor is making a very extreme comment. And mm-hmm. I think part of the fear gets exacerbated in our world because we take these extreme stories and we normalize them.
Correct.
Thinking my school district's doing the same thing, or that church down the street is doing the same thing with their kids that Anna faced with her cultic parents, blah, blah, blah. Uh-huh. And we, instead of really seeing things are not as extreme as our media tries to portray them as.
I do agree that the media takes these isolated incidents and then policy is created that is not good for the majority or the vast majority of people. In these extreme circumstances, absolutely extreme measures are needed. But even those extreme measures aren't going to fix the problem all the time.
But that's how government thinks, right? We need a new policy, and then we've got to take this new policy and apply it uncritically to every situation.
Yeah, I don't.
And that's what you're saying. There's no good solutions that way.
Yeah. I think that's why I just appreciate people that are who devote their lives, CPS workers and people that are, you know, intervening in these circumstances where they can look at each situation as an individual case-by-case basis. You know, people that are CASA advocates, where they are the person that sees and advocates on the child's behalf to the court. Let's see what's best for the child. And I think that on a case-by-case basis, that's what you do in these extreme circumstances, because it's not a one size fits all solution to every one of these circumstances. Most of the time when people reach the age of adulthood or that age where they can begin to kind of make decisions on their own. For me, I was 13 and I ran away thinking this life right here is not for me. I want to be in this life over here. I made that decision. And if you have enough of that within you, that fire in your belly to make that kind of decision and you decide that, then absolutely, I hope and pray that the kind of resources that are needed will come to bear on each of those situations.
And the person that finds you as a runaway will actually care for you and help you rather
yes.
than become part of this thing. Kyle, you work in this environment. You're working with at-risk kids that are really broken. And you're talk about it from your standpoint. Because you work for a government institution sometimes.
I do work for a government institution. And Anna, I just really appreciate your perspective. I love hearing just your thoughts on it in regards to where to come at it. Is it the best to remove the student from the home? Because coming from both a mental health professional in the school district, as well as a former foster parent, it's quite like I'm listening to this story. I'm like, ooh, man, like there's so much going on here. And I agree that it's very much on a case by case basis. It's intriguing to me because I would argue, at least in my clinical work that I have done, that yes, the physical, the sexual abuse trauma is horrific and it has a major impact on students and on individuals, no matter what developmental stage they're in. But for me, the real challenge is the psychological, emotional abuse that's occurring because it's almost impossible to prove. Right. And so, you know, I'm working with students who have had horrific situations that have occurred in their lives as well. And yet we can't justify, we can't prove that these kids are being abused because there isn't any quote unquote evidence of abuse,
right.
even though there's right. tons of obvious cues and red flags uh-huh. that this person is being gaslighted, brainwashed, significant emotional trauma is taking place.
Those are called the hidden abuses
yes.
that don't leave marks and scars on the body.
Yes.
But they leave marks on the mind, the soul, the heart that are sometimes harder to overcome because, one, you don't understand that that's called abuse. I was a grown adult woman in 2015, 16, so not long ago, where I realized that that is also called abuse.
Yeah.
And it blew my mind. The mental health aspect of the kids that are growing up in that, no matter what kind of abuse of situation they're in, the mental health aspect of it is a daunting challenge when they reach adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I've been just studying about trauma, like it's my paying job.
Yeah.
And it's not, but I've been not only for the benefit that I can bring to myself to continue this healing journey because of the trauma, but also because that's what I'm going to be studying. I'm going to be going next fall to get my master's degree. And my focus is going to be trauma-informed spiritual formation.
Mm.
And I can hardly wait to get there.
I bet.
Yeah.
Because of how much this has impacted my life. So my main concern is to say, if you are aware of somebody who is going through this, a child especially, you be that safe person for that child. You know, Oprah said something once that I never forgot. She goes, every child needs someone in their life whose eyes light up when they walk in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know a child in that kind of situation where it's probably not best to rip them away from their family of origin, be that safe person. Be that loving, kind, tender person whose eyes light up when that child walks in the room. It makes a difference. Them experiencing what real love feels like is the light at the end of the tunnel they're going to need when they get to adulthood. You know, I have a whole chapter in my book about my third grade teacher. And the way she interacted with me, she had no idea. She had no clue. I was able to connect with her after the book was published. And, you know, she read that chapter just dumbfounded. She had no idea. But the way she treated me, the way she embraced me, kind of took me under her wing. And I was one of those kids that needed that kind of validation. And school was my safe place. School was a respite.
Yeah.
And she was the one. She gave me that sense of, this is really nice. How it feels in this classroom is nice.
That's a major encouragement, at least as I'm listening to you process through that, because there have been times and I know that the role of CPS is a very, very needed role and a very challenging mm-hmm. role to be in.
Mm-hmm.
But I also, as a mental health professional, have my own challenges with CPS and watching mm-hmm. the process and being so frustrated and angry at the system because there isn't, you know, for whatever reason, a very, very tormented child is staying in a very, very dark situation. And to basically feel like my hands are being tied, other than just being that safe presence for them, that mm-hmm. literally out of, if I can only give them an hour a week where they mm-hmm. are unconditionally loved for mm-hmm. just an hour, then my yes. job is well done.
Yes, you are absolutely making a difference.
And I'd say it's not only true for these children when you find them, also for adult survivors of that, like you.
Yes,
you
know, where you find thank people. You. Yes.
If you can be a safe place for people to fall, the one who lights up when they walk into a room, that's such a great picture of what it is that God's love can convey through our hearts to people who are places of extremity and need and brokenness, that need an invitation to light and healing and wholeness. And we can provide that.
As a grown adult going up, as I was entering into this season of healing, I would go to these women's retreats. I would go to these small group, things that, everything, all these things that people go to, every kind, every variety, I would show up because I loved it. And, when it came time to share or this or process or whatever, I would always be the one sobbing and crying. And then I always felt like the neediest person in the room. And it was because I was. And over time, things, as I healed and grew, there was an event that happened. And I remember sitting around the table with several other women at this retreat, and a woman was sobbing her eyes out at the table. And I'm sitting there offering my presence and comfort at the table. And I was thought to myself, I'm not the neediest person here. It was like a moment for me. And so when you come into contact with somebody and they dare to share their story with you, there's a way that you can show up for them by being a listener, by holding space for that, what they're sharing, and being a witness to the pain that they're going through as they share. That is healing.
Unfortunately, we run out of time. Anna, thank you so much for joining us today. Anna LeBaron, she's the author of The Polygamous Daughter. I'd recommend you read the book just to hold some of the things in your heart that we've talked about today. Not only how to love and see people that we mostly don't want to see in our world. We want to blame the parents and ignore the problem. And the answers to these problems are not sorted out necessarily in the government culture and policy. It's got to be sorted out by humans who care about each other. So thanks, Anna, for joining us today.
I love just getting to hear your story, Anna, and appreciate the boldness that you had, the process that you've taken on. And yeah, it was great to get to chat with you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.